Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen ancestral and unceded lands of the Shukapmak people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbours. Human rights are not negotiable. They are inherent. Every person has these rights just by being alive. But not everyone today understands that this is so, and for those who refuse to grant basic human rights to other members of the human family, there needs to be some presence, be it people, organizations, or legal instruments, that steps up to protect those whose human rights are being ignored, attacked, or dismissed. Today we welcome a guest whose daily task is to actively work to promote and protect the human rights of everyone in her jurisdiction, which is the entire province of British Columbia. Kasari Govender is a lawyer with a master's degree in international human rights from Oxford University, and she is BC's very first ever independent human rights commissioner. A warm welcome to you, Kasari.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we begin talking, I just want to play a short clip from a video you have on your website.
I am deeply passionate and committed to working on human rights. And that is in large part due to the deep roots that my family has in the social justice movements of our time.
So why don't you tell listeners a little bit about how you were immersed in caring for others and the rights of others from very early on? How did that happen?
Well, I was raised in a family, as I noted there, that kind of was involved in various social justice movements. I mean, just in terms of my parents, my mother dedicated her career and much of her life to working on anti-violence issues in particular, so violence against women and children, and worked within government for many years and then within community for many years as a sociologist and a researcher. And her work, in fact, as a bit of an aside, it remains very influential. The government, provincial government, just did a very large report looking at what they should do now on gender-based violence. And they cited her work quite extensively, which was both lovely to see and also rather depressing. She would have been both a little bit pleased, but also mostly horrified that her work continues to be of such relevance. But that was my mother's life's work, and certainly a great influence on me and the way I was raised. And she was raised us as our primary caregiver and a single mother.
Grew up in South Africa.
My dad grew up in South Africa, and I'm mixed race. My mother was white and my father was Indian, but my father's origins are actually in South Africa rather than India many generations back.
Just like Mahatma Gandhi.
That's right. Lots of Indians came over to the African continent. In our case, it was indentured laborers coming over from Tamil Nadu to South Africa. Mm. And so he was raised under apartheid South Africa and grew up with, a lot of that, a lot of the activism, a lot of the trauma that comes from being raised in an extremely racist regime where you were treated as less than human. He certainly brought that analysis to our dinner table.
Did he talk about, there must have been some pretty intense experiences for him. It wasn't just theoretical, it wasn't academic, it was a daily lived experience for him. You must have heard some stories that really aroused your concern.
I did, although he definitely also had first of all, I think it caused a lot of trauma for him, so it wasn't a straightforward thing to talk about.
Right.
I think also, he really had this idea that we were born in Canada, we were born with freedom, and he didn't want it to taint that vision. He didn't want us to kind of mark ourselves as different in some ways, but he certainly brought an interesting analysis. He felt that you needed to laugh in the face of kind of some of the horrors of the world. One of the things that he taught me very, very clearly was he wanted me to be able to argue. He wanted me to be able to state my position clearly. Little did he know how that would come back.
He had no idea. Now, it's interesting, when you found out, when you got the job, the first independent human rights commissioner for BC, you were concerned that you were too young, you didn't have enough street cred, you know, the kind of qualifications that other people had. But when you've described what you've just described now about your family and the immersion that you had in human rights, it almost seems to me as an observer that you were destined for something like this. It was, I hope the judges who approved your appointment realized that at some point. They must have got a sense that you took this really seriously.
I do. I take it extremely seriously. And you know, the legacy goes far beyond my parents. I have lots of activists in different kind of movements on both sides of my family. I think, you know, I'm not sure. I think it does come across in how I present in the world. It's very much who I am. And, you know, I became a lawyer really for the purpose of working in human rights and social justice.
And arguing.
Exactly. I ended up liking the law a lot more than I expected and really kind of valuing it as a tool in a way that I thought it was kind of a means to an end when I first went to law school, but I've enjoyed the means. Someone, and I think that passion as well shines through.
So after you got your law degree, you went to Oxford. Now, that's a long way to go to study. Well, international human rights makes more sense in a country like England. But what was it about Oxford that drew you across the Atlantic? What did they have
I guess when I was 9, my mom took us to Oxford, and I thought, oh, this is what university is. This is so exciting.
All these old buildings.
Those beautiful buildings had a little bit of that sense in my mind, but also they offered a very unusual program, which was a master's in international human rights law that you can mostly do from distance. So it's a program that's designed to not take people out of the field of working in human rights in order to study it. And so that was incredible. And partly why it was incredible, it turned out, it's not necessarily the reason I went, but it turned out it was incredible because it attracted people from all over the world doing the most interesting work. So I learned so much, both from Oxford, but also from my colleagues.
From your fellow students, yes. Yeah. I've had other people tell me stories about that kind of thing. It's the mix. It's like in hospitals, the patients help each other a lot. Sometimes the doctors and nurses do, but the patients often help them a great deal.
Right, exactly.
Now, you might have thought you didn't have a lot of street cred to get this job, but in fact, you had years and years of working actively, 11 years plus with West Coast Leaf. Why don't you describe what you did there? Because that was really quite relevant.
Yeah, I started out as the litigation director and then moved into the executive director role after a couple of years. So as an executive director of a pretty small organization, you wear every hat. So part of that was learning to run an organization. You know, you there is no accountant other than on the board to kind of double check. There's some checks and balances, but you've got to understand all of that. You've got to do all the finances. You've got to get all the grants. You have to work with your team to envision the projects that you're working on. But in that context, we did litigation. So we went to court. We worked on gender-based gender discrimination, a very intersectional approach to gender discrimination. So not isolated only to gender, but looking at gender in the context of race and disability.
And you set up the RISE Women's Legal Center, which was, what was it? Was it an information center or was it a place to focus your legal actions?
It was distinct from West Coast Leaf in the sense that its primary role is direct service. So West Coast Leaf is works on systemic issues. It intervenes in court actions. It educates the public. It does pieces that are looking at trying to change the law. RISE's mandate is to serve women, people who identify as women, who are leaving violent relationships and really trying to support a population that has received very little support from legal aid and access to justice. So it was trying to meet some of that very significant gap that was left in between 2002 and 2005.
And legal aid just for listeners to understand, LEAF, what's the acronym stand for?
Legal Education and Action Fund. which was, yeah, it was really around legal education in action, but it's a bit of a funny acronym now. It's very much known as LEAF. And there's a National LEAF and a West Coast LEAF.
Well, that's a good sign. It spreads across the country. Now, in addition to these kinds of jobs, you also now and in the past have had your foot in the door with academic institutions like UBC and Simon Fraser, involved with some teaching, sharing information, etc. How's that fit in with what you're doing on the ground, this notion of going into academe and bringing really important street issues into that kind of environment?
You know, it was part of what RISE was set up to do as well, because RISE was set up as a student clinic. It's run by staff that certainly provide huge mentorship and represent clients, but there is also, it's kind of student powered. It's a partnership with UBC. And I believe in that in the academic context too. I think academic work is incredibly important to provide some of the deep thought that those of us working on the ground can't always make the time for. But it's also really important to draw those connections. So I, you know, taught about gender and access to justice, trying to tie in some of those issues. At SFU, talked about community leadership and community building issues.
It's a wonderful thing when there is that kind of connection between action in the community and studies in an academic institution. It sort of completes a circle. It's kind of like in agriculture, having extension offices out in the fields with the farmers, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, there's three parts to the human rights system, if you like, or the system that addresses human rights. Your part is the Office of the Human Rights Commissioner. But there's the two other parts. Maybe you could just give a one-sentence description of what the clinic and the tribunal do.
Sure. The Human Rights Tribunal is the body that decides human rights complaints. If you feel like you've been discriminated against by your employer, for example, you bring a complaint to the Human Rights Tribunal, and they're almost like a judge, a court, to make those decisions. And a lot of those cases are settled or mediated. They don't all go to hearing.
And it goes into the legal record, the sort of record of the body of law?
Yes, they issue written decisions. If it does go to hearing, they issue written decisions that are publicly available. As I say, a lot of those cases don't go to full hearing, but they can, and then they could be judicially reviewed at the court if it's like a form of appeal to the court system. The Human Rights Clinic is the publicly funded clinic that will represent complainants going through that process. There are other human rights, there are clinics around the province, legal clinics, that do provide some lawyers or advocates for human rights issues as well. But the primary support is the Human Rights Clinic, run out of Vancouver, but province-wide service.
So let's talk about what your office does, because the very first heading in the division of sort of activities is research. And then right after that is education. So research and education, talk a little bit about how that plays a role in addressing human rights issues.
I mean, one of the key projects that we've done on the research side is provided guidance to government that's ended up being guidance for those beyond government about how to collect disaggregated demographic data. So data around our identities and how that relates to, for example, to public policy. And how to do that in a way that doesn't further harm. Instead, it addresses inequality. Mm-hmm. So let me give you an example of that.
Sure.
We know, for example, that Indigenous people are disproportionately incarcerated. They're disproportionately sent to jail. So if we know that, then we can then start to address the problem. What is it that is leading folks to be so disproportionately incarcerated? And there's all kinds of reasons for this, none of which is that Indigenous people are inherently more likely to commit crimes. And that's what we need to avoid, increasing the stereotypes, and we need to ensure that we're actually using that data to bring down incarceration rates.
You know, there's a little quotation on the website which says a lot about how your leadership style operates, and it is this. As Commissioner Govender has said many times, we cannot act on what we do not know. And the fact that your staff in this public setting quotes you and it stays up there and you didn't say, oh, no, that's too personal, I don't want to talk about that, to me says that the atmosphere in your office must be pretty congenial and sort of mutually supportive. Am I right?
Well, certainly from my perspective, you'd have to talk to our team.
Well, they quoted you. They must think there's something coming out of your mouth that's really worth making a point of. It's lovely, though.
Yeah. I believe we have an amazing team. And, you know, working in a human rights organization is working with a bunch of folks who are really critical thinkers. Mm. So there's no shortage of kind of that critical thinking, but that's what makes it a lively, interesting place to work and a place where people, all of us are held accountable. Our whole jobs is to hold power accountable. So, yeah. You know, you run an organization like that, it's an interesting place to work.
Absolutely. Well, you have to do it at home if you're going to do it in the public space. My guest today is Kasari Govender, BC's Independent Commissioner for Human Rights. Research, education, and then communications is the third arm of what you do. Communications seems to me in this area, that line, you know, we cannot act on what we do not know. It seems to me it applies to you, but it also applies to the public at large and to governments, that you have to tell people stuff. And that's a big part
Absolutely,
of what you do.
Yeah. A really key piece of the work that we've done has been around ensuring that we have evidence-based policy, that our governments, our folks in power are making decisions based on evidence rather than political expediency. And that's a big part of what we've meant by research. It's a big part of our law reform work. It's also a part of the communications work we do. That's been very sort of a strategic piece for me, is that I think communicating well, being out in public, having these conversations with folks, being present in the media, and getting our work out and talked about is an important piece of doing the work. It means that we open ourselves up to a lot of controversy, a lot of vitriol online, and that's part of the job. But I do think our communications work is really important piece of that puzzle. It's a piece of the education too, right? We need to educate the public.
For sure. Along that line, I noticed that on the website, your face and your name are the public image. When you go to the section that says team, there's only one member of the team who becomes visible. I'm wondering what that represents. I was trying to figure it out in my mind. Does it mean that there are sometimes controversial decisions, there's people who feel strongly and get excited and passionate and sometimes a bit obnoxious about what human rights are all about? Is there a kind of a motivation for that process?
Yeah, there's really two things. So one is structural. I am established as an independent officer of the legislature. There is actually no legal entity that is BC's Office of the Human Rights Commissioner. There's only the Human Rights Commissioner under the legislation. And then the commissioner can appoint who she wants to assist with the work. That is important because I'm accountable to the legislature for all of the work. It's not the organization as a whole. So one of those pieces is structural about why it sets established around the person.
Sure.
That's true for all other eight officers of the legislature because there's nine of us in total. We cover all issues around democracy. So ombudsperson, representative for children and youth, elections, and so on, the auditor general. The other piece of it is more strategic or tactical, which is that sort of just what you implied, which is that this work attracts a lot of vitriol and a lot of hate online, and then a lot of critique just even, you know, kind of in the public sphere. Right. I see it as my job to be the face of that and to weather that storm and free up our team to do the excellent work that they do.
I love what you said about your father, that he taught you how to argue, or he wanted you to argue. I mean, it seems to me that that must have sort of battle-hardened you a little bit from the get-go, in the notion that people don't always agree with you, and maybe your father was argumentative at times just to sort of give you a little practice. But it does seem that was another of those things that you might not have realized was an important qualification that allowed you to really do the job so effectively.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, right? You got to keep your skin thick, but your heart soft, because you can't do this work if you're too hardened against the issues. You know, if you don't believe that change is possible, what's the point
Absolutely. In
doing this? You have to have, it's fundamentally optimistic work.
Now, you do some legal stuff, and the legal stuff involves interventions. Maybe you could describe how that process tends to work.
Sure. There's interventions and inquiries within the legal realm. Mm-hmm. Interventions are when we get involved in cases that are already ongoing. We don't represent either side in a dispute. We work on coming in as a third party to say there's something relevant here to human rights more generally. There's a legal issue that goes beyond the confines of this case and stretches further. So, for example, there's a case that's just about to come down this week that is related to UN, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People and its application in BC law. And we were there to argue it has real legal meaning, it has real legal import since they adopted it into legislation. Mm-hmm. Inquiries are a different thing. They're not to do with court. They are public inquiries that folks might know about. That term might be a little bit more familiar to people in the public. Our first public inquiry was into the rise of hate during COVID. We're just finishing up an inquiry that's a very different tone, which is around media being excluded from a certain decampment of a homeless decampment in the downtown East Side. And it's a freedom of the press issue. We're working on another one about use of force by police. Mm. So those are some of, and there's more on the inquiry side. Those are very large scale, year or two, in-depth research and compelling information. So this is a really key piece of this, which is that the teeth here are that I can require public bodies and others to give me information and to give evidence under oath. Can't make them comply with my recommendations.
Under oath.
But I can make them give us good information. And that's been a really powerful tool for change.
Oh, I was going to say, that must really get people anxious, which brings up a whole issue that's central to what you're doing. And that is that you will inevitably be making statements that challenge formal policy by this or that government or this or that political entity. And that's a bit of a tightrope that you have to walk. I know you said when we talked earlier that you avoid talking about international human rights issues and you steer clear of the masking issue during the COVID pandemic. But there's still other situations. For example, I found a quote from the Fifth Estate that Health Canada ignored expert advice to expand access to safe drugs for opioid users, internal documents show. And that was from an article about some of the work you're doing. So there's a point where you delve into government behavior or formal official policy behavior that where you challenge what somebody did. And then, of course, the press comes along and picks the most controversial side of what you said. You might have said, I love all these people to death, but they do this thing. They point the part out where you said they do this thing. What's that like, that tightrope that you walk on?
It's really tricky. I definitely, it's hard to send something out in the world and then see the way in which it can be misrepresented. And we learn something new every time we release that information. I do want to just clarify one thing. I actually did weigh into masks during COVID. I don't speak on issues happening outside of BC and certainly not outside of Canada because my mandate's only here. We do talk about how international law applies here and the right to the highest attainable standard of health and masking in healthcare facilities was one of those issues. But so often what we're said, often enough, what I say is misrepresented or cherry picked in the media. And it's so frustrating because we say controversial things. I say controversial things. You can challenge me on what I actually say. but what's frustrating is when we're kind of shadow boxing misinformation. And it's not really what we put out in the world.
The one area that I think is new in what you're doing, and I think it represents, and we talked briefly about it before the show, getting into the whole climate justice issue, the whole issue of how we don't just protect people as individuals in their own lives, but we protect the community in a broad sense from something that really isn't illegal, but it is powerfully influential on people's health and well-being and natural justice. Why don't you talk about it a little bit? Because that, I believe, is a new segment of what you're doing.
Yeah, we are using climate justice as more of a kind of filter or a lens on what we do these days. And one of the ways, for example, that's showing up is when we look at discrimination. One of the issues around discrimination we want to pull out is the right to cool and access for people who can't afford cooling in their house. So they're living in overheating conditions on a heating planet. What obligation do we have to have internal spaces that where people can regulate the temperature in an appropriate way, even if they can't afford it? And how does that show up in a discriminatory? Who disproportionately experiences that? It is an inevitability that we need to grapple with these issues because in a tragic, deeply unfortunate way, this is the world that we live in. And there's no question that it's the existential threat of our existence, and human rights don't don't exist separately from that.
Indeed. And it is now starting to become recognized in international law and by decisions by governments and acts of governments that say all citizens have a right to a healthy, safe environment. I want to close with talking a little bit about stigma, because stigma is a Greek word, but it means labeling somebody illegitimately for something, some quality or aspect of their character, their appearance, their behavior, their any sort of thing that identifies them as being what they are. And it's around the whole, particularly around the whole process of the safe drug availability things. When I've read this statistic before, but on your website it says 16,000 people have died from toxic drugs since the public health emergency was declared in 2016. And, you know, they, in 1 month, 158 people. To me, that's an astonishing effect of what is indisputably stigma from the beginning to the end. It's not that these are bad people. They are people who are, generally speaking, covering pain with chemical relief. Do you want to talk about that? That must be a pretty heartfelt issue for you as a person, but also as the commissioner.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. You know, I'm like so many other British Columbians, have been touched by this issue personally, and also we've released a statement just earlier in November around the toxic drug crisis and a human rights-based response. And I couldn't agree with you more that a stigma is a key driver of this, both in terms of people trying to seek help and not being able to, you know, facing all kinds of obstacles in doing so because of stigma, and also because of the system. I mean, that we don't treat this issue with the urgency that we would treat any other health crisis with this kind of outcome.
The numbers of deaths are astonishing under our nose. You know,
incredible. I mean, it's the leading cause of death in the province for folks between 19 and 59. This is a crisis that absolutely deserves more than a criminal justice response. And it should be treated with the same compassion and scientific rigor as any other health crisis that we might be facing.
Maybe we can close with you giving a brief description of what it was like to go and be invested as the commissioner. It was clearly a family and a heartwarming event, as well as the honor that was went along. Why don't you describe what that experience, what happened and what was like?
Sure. I found out a couple of days before that I had gotten the job, and it was a whirlwind couple of days, informing my employer, my West Coast Leaf, and the board, and my family. And I flew over with my family for the appointment. My son was four, and he snored all the way through my appointment in the legislature, which was a great part of that memory.
A great leveling experience.
Exactly. A very, very humbling experience, and just sort of a wonderful beginning to try to imagine what this could be, because we started with just words in a piece of law.
You didn't even have an office. You had to set it all up.
I had my laptop in my backpack. We had one staff that started out with me and quickly to be joined by one other, and some temporary folks who were all working our tails off to try to imagine what this would be, as well as set up the building blocks. But I think that visionary piece, that creative piece of breathing life into this piece of legislation was really a greatest honor for me.
Kasari, I regret we only have a half hour today, but I am delighted to have you on the show, and someday we'll, I hope, have you back again to talk about some other issues. You've really set a tone for the office that I think is admirable and full of sort of love and affection, as well as some hard work at making sure that the law is adequate, protecting people and their human rights. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to chat.
You've heard BC's Commissioner for Human Rights, Kasari Govender, describe her work protecting the human rights of citizens, something that is important in every part of the world. Now we're joined by a guest who works in another way to protect human rights in BC. Laura Track is the director of the BC Human Rights Clinic, a position that from time to time brings her to engage with the Human Rights Tribunal, a form of court that determines if a citizen has experienced a breach of their basic rights as a member of the human community. Laura's days therefore can involve working one-on-one with individual clients, as well as undertaking a wide range of other educational and advocacy activities. Laura, it's a great pleasure to have you join us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, before you joined the clinic, you had quite a lot of experience in dealing with human rights before that time, worked with the BC Civil Liberties Association for several years, West Coast LEAF, the Legal Education and Action Fund, which addresses women's rights, Pivot Legal Society, helping people who are impoverished and marginalized. And to start your career, you were a law clerk for six Supreme Court judges. Now you're working directly with clients, not only on policies and education activities and advocacy campaigns. Now, how has that changed your perspective and your feeling about the work you do? Because I believe it's the first time you've really got into that side of things.
Yeah, it's true. The work that I was doing in the earlier parts of my career was definitely human rights work in the kind of broad sense of the term of human rights.
Right.
And at Pivot, I did a lot of work on housing-related issues. West Coast LEAF, we were very focused on women's equality and access to justice. But here at the Human Rights Clinic, I am representing clients with human rights complaints before the BC Human Rights Tribunal. And it's a really, really different way of working. In the advocacy work that I was doing previously, you know, we worked hard to inform the positions and advocacy work that we were doing with the voices and perspectives of community. But here at the Human Rights Clinic, I am directly representing and trying to give voice to the individual experiences mm-hmm. of my clients and seek justice and accountability for them on a really individual level. And so rather than kind of targeting these big picture policies and mm-hmm. seeking those more systemic reforms, mm-hmm. I'm advocating for the interests of my clients and mm-hmm. really working one-on-one with individual people every day. Which I love, which I find really rewarding.
I was going to ask you, how is that different? How does that engage you personally? And it sounds like it really is a little more captivating at the moment you're doing it.
I find it really rewarding. Systemic law reform and advocacy work is a labor of love and a real long-term project where you really have to remember to sort of look for the light at the end of the tunnel and appreciate that it is a long-term project.
Right.
The files that I work on now can be long-term projects, but can also result in real meaningful outcomes for folks within a matter of months. And, you know, my interaction with this individual and their particular human rights issue may not last very long, but we're able to work together to achieve a solution to their situation that works for them and
sure.
they can move on with their lives. So I appreciate that kind of immediate gratification, actually,
yes, well,
in getting to resolve these situations more quickly.
As a family physician, I can certainly endorse that there's a lot of involvement goes on dealing one person at a time. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could, because you've worked in so many areas, if you could maybe just parse a little bit some of the differences between, say, civil rights or civil liberties and human rights, just because you told me when we were talking earlier that some people come along thinking that they've got a human rights issue, but it really is mm-hmm. something else. So just those two categories, civil rights and human rights, let's start with that. What is sort of the basic difference between the two?
Well, civil rights, I think, are an aspect of human rights. The challenge that often arises in the context of the work that I do is that human rights is such a big concept and encapsulates and captures so many important rights that we think of as fundamental human rights, like the right to housing, the right to clean drinking water, the right to an adequate standard of living. These are human rights in that kind of big picture sense. But our human rights code, which is the law that I work with every day and the law that the Human Rights Tribunal applies, it is about discrimination. The Human Rights Code protects people from discrimination in their jobs, in their housing, and in their access to services. So many times we will have folks coming to us, a human rights clinic, saying, my human rights have been violated, when what they mean is that they're living in substandard housing or experiencing homelessness, or their reserve doesn't have clean drinking water.
Right.
And those are not necessarily situations to which the Human Rights Code applies, or situations where a complaint to the Human Rights Tribunal is going to be their path to resolution of that issue. So the distinction that I'm all often grappling with is the distinction between human rights as a big picture concept that all of us enjoy by virtue of being human, and the human rights that are protected by BC's Human Rights Code, which are really quite limited to those protections from discrimination.
Yeah, I'm sure there are people who must come on a regular basis, as you've just described, thinking this has got to be my human rights being infringed upon. And you're in the, it would seem to me, a challenging position of saying, well, yeah, this is a very unpleasant situation, but the rules don't include your circumstance in what's going on. So how do you deal with the people who don't fit into the human rights rubric? What do you do? Because they must, you want to help them. So what do you do at that point?
Yeah, well, ideally there's another option for them. And maybe that's a legal option. You know, maybe it's not a human rights issue, but it is a matter that the residential tenancy branch could deal with, or that they might have a claim in court in some way, and we can refer them to another service provider. Sometimes it's a systemic issue that doesn't necessarily lend itself to litigation, and maybe we can refer them to the Office of the Human Rights Commissioner to investigate and look into that broader systemic human rights issue, even if a case is not going to be the path to change. Maybe it's something that advocacy or education could help out with. But, you know, ultimately, we see our responsibility as giving people a sense of the landscape and what the law protects and what it doesn't protect. And sometimes do you have to explain to folks that, you know, there's a box that you have to sort of squeeze your experience into in order to use this tool of a complaint to the Human Rights Tribunal, and your situation may just not quite fit into that box. So let's explore where else you might be able to go.
Another box that you could get into. Now, one thing about a decision made by the tribunal, and you on the website where it's describing what you do, one of the things you're aiming for is lasting solutions. Now, it seems to me one of the things that happens with a tribunal decision is that they become part of, if I'm not using the right term, case law, they become part of a decision-making, if a legal decider of, trier of fact, I learned that phrase, is doing his or, that's the judge, or in this case, a tribunal chair. If they're doing their job properly, then the decision and its success means that it goes into the kind of stuff that other legal situations, people in other legal situations can look at, and they can cite it and say, you can't do this thing because of that tribunal decision. That's the kind of, is that kind of the lasting solution sort of thing that you're thinking about with those sort of decisions and that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Yeah. The tribunal's decisions, I mean, are of course meaningful for the individuals involved because they may result in a remedy for their specific situation, but they also provide really important guidance to others. And in the course of the education work that our human rights clinic does, we are very much guided by and informed by the tribunal's decisions over the years, which have said that this kind of conduct is likely to breach the code. And here are the things that an employer or a landlord or a service provider can do in order to avoid a finding of discrimination, to take effective action to address a human rights situation, to respond appropriately. And so we can offer that guidance, that information from the decisions of the Human Rights Tribunal to say, hey, you know, this is onside, and this kind of conduct may end up in, you may end up in hot water for going this direction. Human rights tribunal decisions are not binding, so the tribunal doesn't have to follow the decisions that other tribunal members have made, but they're certainly persuasive, and the members look to each other's decisions for guidance about how to approach any particular situation.
I like the way you phrased it, an importer can avoid a circumstance where he or she would be in breach of somebody's human rights, sort of like quietly appealing to his or her self-interest, as it were, whether they understand the real issues or not.
Yeah, it's what we all want, right?
Yeah,
the
challenge
of any litigation system is that you can't file a complaint and take action until the harm is done. So we all have, I think, an interest in trying to prevent the harm from happening in the first place. And everybody would like to stay out of the litigation process if they possibly can.
The look before you leap principle, we might call it. Mm-hmm. Now, Just to give listeners a little bit of an idea of how your time is distributed, when you're in the office and or doing your formal job, how much time is spent on one-on-one and how much time is spent on, I mean, just give a little bit of an outline of the pattern that you work, meetings, consultations, phone calls, documents.
Yeah.
Lawyers always have lots of documents.
Lots of documents. Mm. Oh my goodness. Well, our mandate, the mandate of our clinic and what we are funded by the provincial government to do is to assist people who have made or are thinking about making human rights complaints. And so that really is the bulk of our work. The vast majority of my day is spent working on my files and speaking with my clients and reviewing their matters, reviewing their very voluminous documents, packages, and evidence related to their files, and giving advice. Mm-hmm. We also offer something we call a short service clinic every Wednesday, which is just half-hour summary advice appointments to people who are not our clients, but who sign up for an appointment and can speak with one of us for a half an hour to get some guidance about a situation they may be experiencing. Mm-hmm. So we do that that weekly. And, you know, over the last day or so, I just got off the phone with a client. I've got another client with a massive evidence package that needs review. I'm engaged in settlement negotiations with respondents on many files. Lots of human rights complaints resolve through negotiation. Mm-hmm, that's a big part of our work. Right. So working with the opposing party or their lawyer to reach a resolution of the complaint that everyone can live with. Those are sort of the main day-to-day tasks of my job. But I do a lot of education work as well, which I really enjoy. So not every day, but fairly frequently, I'll have somebody who's requested a workshop or a training where we can get into the protections of the Human Rights Code and help people understand both their rights, but also their responsibilities and obligations under the code and that kind of preventative function that we were talking about before.
I just want to remind listeners that I'm speaking today with Laura Track, who is the director of the BC Human Rights Clinic under the Community Legal Assistance Society. Now, speaking of prevention and negotiation, there's a term that's used often in the legal world, and that's mediation. And mediation as opposed to seeking a settlement. Now, there's not only a fundamental difference in between mediation and an actual case brought before the tribunal. Mediation is starting to take a larger role, is it not, in the resolution of conflicts and disputes and or cases where, you know, human rights may or may not have been abrogated. What's good and not good about mediation? What's good, it seems to me, is it gives people an opportunity to actually talk to each other and go over a wider range of things. That's good.
Mediation is invaluable in the human rights context, and one really fantastic aspect of the Human Rights Tribunal and its process is that they offer mediation to the parties early in the process. And actually, whenever the parties request a mediation, the tribunal will set that up. They've got a roster of some really terrific mediators who will work with the parties to, as you say, like facilitate a conversation, an opportunity where appropriate for the parties to talk to one another and to try to come to a better understanding of what's happened and to strategize and figure out what resolution is going to work to solve this problem and resolve this complaint. So they are so positive in the sense of the parties are in control of the outcome,
right,
and have the opportunity to be creative, to negotiate resolutions to complaints that, frankly, a human rights tribunal just simply couldn't order because it would be outside of their sort of jurisdiction or power to order the kind of thing that would help to solve the problem. So that sort of breadth of possibility is a really positive aspect of negotiating and doing mediation type work and really centering the needs of the parties, the complainant, the person harmed in particular, to really craft a resolution that's going to work for them.
The one thing that seems to be a bit of a disadvantage with mediation is that nothing goes into sort of a legal record, so that if a solution is found, it isn't something that the tribunal folks can actually draw on when they're saying, well, this is what worked in this situation, so we'll try it in this, that kind of thing. It doesn't seem to get into that realm.
That's right. Mediations and any settlement discussion is typically confidential and without prejudice. So there's no record of settlements reached. And there can be challenging situations arising where the compromise that the respondent is looking for is confidentiality in exchange for the settlement. And not just confidentiality over the settlement terms, but an agreement to keep the circumstances giving rise to the complaint confidential. Folks will be familiar likely with the concept of non-disclosure agreements,
yes, indeed,
or NDAs, and those are quite commonly sought by respondents to human rights complaints in exchange for the compensation that they may be willing to offer to settle the complaint. And that can raise very difficult considerations for people who've been harmed by discrimination, by harassment, and create situations where they are silenced from talking about their experience if they want to reach a resolution of their complaint.
So would it be fair to say that overwhelmingly non-disclosure agreements of one sort or another are sought by the respondent, but not the person who's the complainant, the person who's had been injured or feels they've been injured, but the person who is saying, okay, we'll admit it, but don't tell anybody. We'll admit it and we'll give you some compensation, but don't tell
they
anybody.
They never admit it. They never admit it. That's another challenge too. A settlement is typically agreed to without any admission of liability. And that can be quite unsatisfying.
Well, Laura, I'm just listening.
Harmed by discrimination.
I'm feeling dissatisfied just hearing about you describe the status of dissatisfaction of other people. It's sort of, that seems to be a very common thing. How many, you know, we paid out $5 million, but we have not admitted any wrongdoing. Do you think that actually fools anybody into thinking that there wasn't any wrongdoing? Or is it just a kind of a legal protection that they're seeking?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you agree to compensate somebody in the realm of $5 million if you know you haven't done anything wrong. There's a bit of a sort of legal dance to all of this, right?
Yeah, indeed.
Not admitting liability, but agreeing to settle a disputed claim for a certain amount of compensation. But that the disclosure piece can be a really challenging aspect of negotiating and something that can be a deal breaker
for
in
sure.
some cases.
I can imagine it would be. Now, if somebody walks in, I don't know if this is how you do it, but if you walk in the door of the clinic saying, hi, I have a problem, can you just do a little bit of the triage process that takes place? Imagining somebody listening to this show says, well, I'm thinking I have a problem. What would be the first steps?
what we would say is, if you have not yet filed a human rights complaint and would like to talk to someone from our clinic about whether your experience could be a human rights violation and how to go about filing a human rights complaint, you should make an appointment with our short service clinic. That's the Wednesday summary advice clinic. We have appointments that go all day from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. actually, into the evening. We will accommodate people if they need to come in person. Lots of folks that we serve are pretty marginalized. Not everyone has a phone or a computer that they can use to attend appointments with us. So if they want to come back in person with an appointment, we're happy to accommodate that. For people who have already filed a human rights complaint and have been told by the Human Rights Tribunal that the complaint is moving forward, it's been accepted and is proceeding, they can then apply for legal representation from our clinic. We have an online process for doing that. Or again, if someone struggles to use online processes, they can give us a call. We'll walk them through the intake form. They can apply for representation. And we have lawyers and legal advocates that do provide representation when we have the capacity to do so. Right. I'm sure you can imagine that, you know, a legal clinic providing free legal representation in a process where literally thousands of people are making human rights complaints each year. We do not have the capacity to provide representation to everyone that applies, but we do our best to assist as many people as we can.
I'm imagining, well, I've seen lineups outside medical clinics, people who want to, you know, they stand out in the cold waiting to be let in the door. If there is a what seems to be a legitimate human rights issue, then if I understand correctly, that goes to the tribunal and they're the decision-making body about whether they think it's actionable, if I can use that term.
They are the decision-making body, and so they would screen a complaint and apply a very low threshold at screening. Does this complaint allege a violation of the code? Is this within our jurisdiction? Is this something that we could deal with? And provided that it is, and it was filed in time, there's a one-year limitation period, provided that it sort of meets those basic requirements, the complaint is in. It's screened in. And eventually may have to be adjudicated by a decision maker at the Human Rights Tribunal. Right. The tribunal doesn't investigate complaints. That's something that surprises people sometimes, that many people are more familiar maybe with an ombudsperson's office or making a police complaint or report to WorkSafe, where somebody investigates what's going on. A human rights complaint is much more like a lawsuit. You file your complaint and eventually you will have to bring forward the evidence to prove your complaint. There's nobody at the tribunal that sort of investigates the situation to try to get to the bottom of it and decide what happened.
One of the things that struck me was that there have been, because of increased volumes of people seeking help, and a couple of events like the pandemic and various other things, the volume has increased, and so the timing and the duration of appeal processes has now been really extended considerably, the average time. Just describe what that's like, because it's really, that's a more than doubling of the length of time it takes for a typical complaint to work through the system.
Yeah, it's a very slow process. And you're right that during the pandemic, the number of complaints really spiked. Many of them were related to public health measures implemented in response to the pandemic. But even since those public health measures have gone away, we've still seen a really high volume of complaints filed each year, to the extent that the tribunal is just incredibly backlogged and things take a very, very long time. So the advice that we have to give folks is that if you filed a complaint today, you could likely expect it to take at least 5 years before your complaint was at a tribunal hearing, being decided by a tribunal member. Mediations and resolutions through that process can happen much more quickly, but even then, you're still looking at a couple of years to wait for the tribunal to screen your complaint and set it up for mediation. So it is a slow, lengthy process, and wasn't always like that before the pandemic. things moved along much more quickly. You could expect to get to a hearing and a decision in maybe more like 2 to 3 years, which then felt like a long time. But yeah, relatively speaking, we pine for those days.
A couple of things. We should kind of close out our chat. But there's a couple of things you mentioned. The TRC has had an effect on bringing forward Indigenous rights issues. And the Me Too movement has been another influential factor in raising, say, public awareness and general consciousness about these kinds of issues. How much have they contributed to the volume of cases that you see?
Yeah, it's really interesting to watch how sort of events, world events, and social awareness sort of drives complaints before the Human Rights Tribunal. The Me Too movement had a huge impact, both on the number of complaints filed and awareness about sexual harassment, particularly in the workplace context, and also in requests for education. We had a lot of restaurants and hotels and just other organizations wanting to get out ahead of this issue and get some training, get some education about, okay, what does human rights law require us to do? How do we prevent these situations from arising in the first place? And how do we respond if they do arise? The tribunal has also done quite a lot of work to increase awareness amongst Indigenous communities of its services and what it does and what the Human Rights Code protects. Mm-hmm. And the government actually added Indigenous identity as a protected ground of discrimination in the Human Rights Code. So those changes, I think, have really driven a rise in the number of complaints filed by Indigenous people. So yeah, these moments really do have an impact on our collective awareness of human rights protections and also the opportunities that exist to seek accountability for violations.
We don't live in a vacuum. We don't live in a vacuum. Laura Track is the director of the BC Human Rights Clinic. Laura, it's really been helpful and valuable and interesting and enjoyable to have you on the show. Thank you very much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much, Warren. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you've enjoyed this edition of Planetary Conversations. This program is produced by Tom Grady and Jeanette Clement for CKVS Community Radio in Salmon Arm, BC. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. I hope you will join me for another edition of Planetary Conversations.